obviously I'm going to be talking about suffragettes, but before I get stuck into that, I'm just going to state my sources, because it's supposed to be a historian. Main ones being One Hand Tied Behind Us, a book by an academic from Leeds University called Jo Lidington. Another one of her books called The Suffragette. The Ascent of Women by Melanie Phillips. The Strange Death of Liv Lingman by George Bainfield. And In Letters of Gold by Rosemary Taylor. Okay, so suffragettes, obviously suffrage and enfranchisement. We're talking the suffragette era between 1903 and 1914. And in Britain and in America, I think it's sort of a bit different in terms of who was enfranchised and who wasn't. I believe in America that women had the vote in some states at different times, but not others. So to put into context, there were three main reform bills to enfranchise the population before 1903. One in 1832, what I talked earlier about a failed one in 1831. And in 1832, this enfranchised about 20% of the adult male population, generally upper classes and like aristocracy and bourgeoisie. Another one in 1867, and then the last one in 1884. None of these enfranchised any women at all. In fact, the 1832 Reform Act was the first one to explicitly say no women at the vote. And after the 1884 Reform Act, like most men in Britain, a whole men from a genre of all of different classes had a vote, but no women did. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about a quote that I got from a woman named Dora Montefiore, who I'll be talking about later, who was a British communist. We're talking about radical history today, as we said, about uncovering hidden histories and stuff like that. And my one is really sort of like touching on what Roger did, is challenging established narratives. The suffragettes seemed really quite radical, but we were, I think it was at his house, talking about it. We were questioning really how radical were they. Not just in their means, their militancy, and them chaining themselves to railings, all this, but what were they actually aiming for? So, the suffragettes were mainly run by a family called the Pankhurst family, you might have heard of, British family, who, these Pankhurst women are put up on a historical pedestal, and it seemed that women gaining the vote is generally down to their work. These women are sort of given all the credit for it. And I want to bring them down from this historical pedestal. Doing my exams in school, I was studying suffragettes. And going through the textbooks, I was thinking, well, what on earth are working class women doing at this point? How could you have such an amazing movement that only a small number of people managed to do from a very elite social status? It didn't really make sense. So I did a lot of research to try and find out what working class women were doing and why they aren't attributed any credit in sort of established narratives and in history as we know it. Pankhurst and suffrage have become synonyms in Britain, and they really shouldn't be. And the contribution of other female activists and groups have been really marginalised, and they need to be rehabilitated. And we need to think really about how much the suffragette movement really contributed towards wider feminism, not just enfranchisement. Just a little bit of a brief history. There are two main types of suffrage campaigner. The original battle for suffrage for women in England started in 1865 with the suffragists. Now, suffragists are peaceful campaigners. They use sort of constitutional methods, they petition, they lobby MPs. And their organisation is called the National Union for Women's Suffrage Societies. Now, these women have gained small victories in regards to getting women more involved in public life. But as we said, in 1865 they started their campaign, and yet in 1903, when the suffragettes are really set up, women still don't have the vote. That's almost 40 years of campaigning. The second type of campaigner is a suffragette. Their organisation is called the Women's Social and Political Union. again, set up, this is founded in 1903 by the Pankhurst family in Manchester, and it becomes militant from 1905 onwards. Suffragette, the word, was a phrase coined by the Daily Mail at the time. It was seen as quite, being used as quite a derogatory word, like et meaning little, to try and put down these women and what they were thinking, but they, right, took it on, and they said, no, we're not going to stand for that, we're going to use it, and use it for our identity. So Pankhurst family then, in the middle there is Emmeline Pankhurst and her daughter Christabel Pankhurst. Emmeline, Christabel, Sylvia and Adela were the main founders of this militant movement. They were the wife and the daughters of a sort of left-wing politician who died in 1897 called Richard Pankhurst. And the society to begin with really sort of embraces left-wing, more sort of that way leaning, that way inclined policies and convictions. Their first aim is to try and recruit more working class women and to try and put pressure on the IRP, the Independent Labour Party, at the time. But as you'll see later on, they seem to move away from this. And then you start to question, well, how radical really were they? Okay, so thinking about how radical a group is, you could think about, well, how does it structure itself? Is it a democracy? Is it an autocracy? And the Women's Social and Political Union, which I'm going to be calling the WSPU because it's a bit of a mouthful, is run under a system of hierarchy. So women sort of rank and file, they don't have much of a say in what goes on. Emmeline and Christabel and Sylvia are the central committee of the group. And they basically have a subcommittee who are their friends and family to help them make decisions. And at home sessions where they invite women to come and sort of sit around and they can discuss the ideas they've come up with and how they want to initiate them. And then 11 regional officers who be going around the country and telling women of all these different branches what to actually be doing, what they've decided. But I think what's really important to note straight away is that this is a group which is campaigning for democracy and to be part of a democracy of a country in which they live. But straight away, they don't practice that within their own organisation, which I think is quite strange. It was one of the first reasons that I started to question how radical the suffragettes and their organisation really were. It's been quite critiqued as quite hypocritical, the fact that they weren't democratic themselves. Emmeline Pankhurst explicitly stated that she wanted her women to walk in step and take their instructions like an army, which I think really sums up their approach to how they're going to structure the organisation. Okay, so as I said, the initial aim was to recruit more working class women. So they start off, they really want to get all women involved. They've got these ideas which are rooted in a more socialist background. But Christabel, who is the oldest daughter, is made the official leader of the WSPU and the sort of, I don't know, the autocrat. With her decisions that she takes in between, I'd say, 1903 and 1907 particularly, all these convictions which the group was ingrained in to begin with sort of are lost and they move away from them. An example of this is the move from Manchester, where it was founded, Manchester's in the north of the country, down to London. And this sort of showed a physical representation of how the group had moved away. It moved away in the fact that originally they were very into working with the Independent Labour Party at the time. At the time of this, the leader was really sympathetic to the cause of votes for women. But they moved away and decided they didn't want to be part of such an organisation with such ideas. Christabel says that she didn't want the group to be involved in party politics. But there's another, quite a lot of other reasons which I found out about. The group wanted to raise £20,000, and obviously in order to do that, you're going to need to recruit women from the social elite. Women from the social elite, middle class, women from, like, I don't know, bourgeoisie, place, people like that, they're not going to be impressed with you working with a political party which is aims towards helping and advancing the workers. So that's another reason for it, I guess. But another thing is, well, what Christabel says is that she thinks the Houses of Parliament should be more impressed by the demonstrations of the feminine bourgeoisie than of the feminine proletariat. And you sort of see how they've gone from a group founded on working class ideologies and they just move away and they start saying things like that. Again, this is easier to recruit middle class women, but it starts to become more fashionable in middle class, and it distances working class women further. When you have a group which is mainly people from a certain class, it distances the women from the other classes, in that, say when you have your meetings or at home sessions, would be in an area that was middle class, and a working class woman wouldn't be expected to be in that area at the time. Another difference is working class women had to work, obviously, and the way they structured their meetings and their demonstrations and things were not at a time where anyone could attend and join in. They were at a time where only certain women could, because the others had to work and earn a living, because their income was so important to their families. This phrase was described by Sylvia Pankhurst as an example of Christabel's incipient Toryism. You find in lots of sources lots of friction, both politically, obviously because they're sibling, it's between Christabel and Sylvia. And as you'll see later on, they're sort of icons of separate ideas and aims and ways of doing things that she self-produces. So this is what Sylvia said, summed up Christabel's views. She said, a working woman's movement is of no value. Working women are the weakest position of the sex. How could it be otherwise? Their lives are too hard, their education too meager to equip them for the contest. Surely it is a mistake to use the weakest in the struggle. We want picked women, the very strongest and the most intelligent. What you have to think here now is the Greek trying to get women vote, but only some women, and they're really, instead of trying to get equality throughout all of society, they're imposing new inequalities and class differences, which originally they wouldn't have done. What they were actually aiming for, unlike what's popularly perceived, is they were aiming for votes for women on equal terms to men. And whether a man could vote depended on a property qualification. As I said, the 1884 Reform Act enfranchised most men. I think you had to pay £10 of rent or earn so much a year that you could vote as a man. The problem with this is that if they're campaigning for votes for women who have this, then again, only a certain number of really wealthy women would have the money to be able to join in and to be enfranchised. And if, again, like, their aims are not as radical as their actions. They go and they are militant, but they're only trying to get a limited measure of franchise. If women were to have been enfranchised on this, then only 1/6 of the electorate would have been female. And you have to think, how much really could that have achieved in ways of trying to better life for women in general? As I said, the organisation was quite middle class. The woman on the left is Christabel Pankhurst. This is her friend Annie Kenny. She was the only working class organiser of the WSPU. Although she did organise things and she did do a lot of work for the campaign, but she's seen by some historians as a face, so that people don't think that they are trying to distance working class women. They use her so that they won't be criticised. The idea of only enfranchising a small thing a small, like, majority of women, minority of women, is criticised. It said that it's not votes for women, but it's votes for ladies. Mm. And again, that's a quote from Dora Montefiore. Okay, so many women who were originally part of the movement just broke away. They thought, no, we're not being involved in this, it's too elitist. And they feel like the Pankhurst have really sold out the original, sold out just to try and get whatever they can. And it's become too exclusively middle class. And these are some examples of women who broke away and why they did it. Yes. So wait, here she is, Dora Montefiore and Adelaide Knight. They set up a branch of the Women's Social and Political Union in London. As I said, it was run under a system of hierarchy, so whether or not a branch would be set up would be the decision, not of women who felt the initiative to go and spread this idea, try and get it out, but it would be decided by the Pankhurst. Now, these two women just went out and set up this organisation, which the Pankhurst really weren't happy about. They had strong words with them about it. Another problem with the Canning Town branch that they in London was that it advocated adult suffrage being universal suffrage for both men and women, and that was a big point of friction between these two women, women of this branch, and the mainstream organisation. They said that they'd broken their promises to the working women, which it was founded by. What I find really interesting is the splits within the family, which reflect the splits within the movement, and how far and how really mean Emily could be, and how far she'd go to try and get this limited measure. Adela Pankhurst was the youngest sister, and she was described as the black sheep among organisers. When they split away from the Independent Labour Party, people who founded the group, who had quite left-wing convictions, had to really keep their mouths shut. They weren't allowed to express what they said because they didn't want to offend women who could give them financial support. So Adela Pankhurst, this is Emmeline's daughter, doesn't manage to do that. She makes a speech advocating adult suffrage, which is goes completely against what her mother thinks, and her mother banishes her, which is a quote I found in about several books, banishes to Australia. She says, here's £200, I want you to emigrate to the other side of the world. And I think Theresa Billings of Red is the most probably well-known person who was against the WSP and broke away from them. She founded the Women's Freedom League. Her problem with it was mainly that it wasn't very democratic. In 1907, she wrote up a new constitution which she was going to present at a congress of lots of different representatives of all the branches of the union to come together. She presented this to Emmeline, and what it basically did, it gave women, all women who were involved, more of a say in what was going to happen, what their policies were going to be, when they were going to be doing things, and what they actually were. Emmeline tore this up dramatically in front of everybody and said, nobody has to be in my army if they don't want to be. And this is a quote from Theresa, and it basically sums up everything, all the different reasons why women split away. It said that WSPU has cut down its demand for one of sex equality for one of votes on a limited basis. It has suppressed free speech on fundamental issues. It has gradually edged the working class element out of the ranks. It has become socially exclusive, politically correct, gracefully fashionable, ultra-respectable, and narrowly religious. This isn't, in mainstream, when you learn about this in school, you have to learn about this in England when you're 14 years old. And you're just told that these women were great and they're really radical. None of this is spoken about. And again, this is trying to establish, well, no, challenge, establish narrative. Female chartists, sort of from the 19th century, distanced themselves from any ideas of suffrage movement because they were always brought up by middle class women. What is interesting is how some feminist movements internationally sort of do follow a trend like of being quite exclusively one group of people who are generally educated. An example of this is in 1848, some feminist activities here in New York, where the women who were like meeting together and organising did not make the effort to try and include factory workers and black women, who arguably were the most oppressed in the country. The other thing I want to talk about is militancy. Obviously, it shows how passionate they are. It was mainly their aim was to publicise the movement, to get it into the national headlines and make people way more aware of what was going on. But there's some aspects of it, and I want to really question how radical things were. This is a picture of Emily and Christabel in prison in Holloway Jail. Suffragettes would get themselves in situations to try to be arrested. And obviously this would play upon society's sort of free... What the problem was suffragettes were middle class, and so they weren't women who would have been to prison at the time. They were trying to get these respectable women to be put in prison so that society would be shocked. Why are you doing this to respectable women? But this distance and really annoyed working class women more, because they were thinking, well, we've always been sent to prison for what we've been doing. It's quite interesting to note that when one middle class suffragette dressed up in working class clothing, when she was taken to prison along with her sort of suffragette comrades, she was treated a lot worse. She was beaten. She was had a lot less privileges, as they did, in the prison. So the suffragettes are trying to campaign to be recognised as part of the democracy and be as strong as possible as men and worthy of respect. But sometimes they try and play the victim, and they deliberately try to get themselves put in prison and say, look what men are doing to us. Look how we're being treated in these prisons. And this was seen by some people as counterproductive, because they're not trying to say we are equal to men and we can be treated in the same way. They're trying to play on this perception that women need greater care and special consideration. Then the idea of distancing working class women was a feature of some of the militant activities. The suffragettes set fire to this race course in 1913. When the level of militancy escalated to arson, quite a few people broke away, including Sylvia Pankhurst, because they thought they're doing far too much for a too small a measure of franchise, and it's going too far. The thing with setting fire to stuff and being put in prison, working class women found it really difficult then to contribute to the movement. Because if they were to be put in prison, they would be in a real problem. Middle class women had servants and maybe maids or someone to look after their children, to clean and cook and be in their homes. Working class women didn't have the sort of safety net that middle class women did. And that's why this does distance them even further. Another thing about questioning how radical they were was what else were they doing in society at that time? What were they trying to achieve? The WSPU was ultimately and only campaigning for the vote. That's what they saw as the be-all and end-all of campaigning. Emily says, our members are absolutely single-minded. They concentrate all their forces on one object, political equality with men. No member of the WSPU divides their attention between suffrage and other social reforms. That means these sort of social elite middle class women weren't really allowed by the leaders to join in with other social issues. Other groups I'm going to talk about later thought, well, what on earth is the point in that? Why are you trying to get the vote if you're not going to imagine how it could be used in areas such as campaigning for birth control and equal pay in work? Next one. I've spoken quite a lot about Emmeline and Christabel and how really how there are misconceptions towards them. And I'm going to talk about Sylvia, who was quite a bit different in many, many ways. Sylvia is called in England the most prolific female British communist there ever was. And obviously she was not happy when they started to move away from the ideologies and the concepts that she helped found this group on. In 1912, she went to London with her American friend, Sally Emerson, against Christabel and Emily's will and advice. And she wanted to go and set up a group and a part of a branch of the union in the East End of London, which is much more working class. And she elected to speak on behalf of working class women, which was something they really didn't want them to do. They didn't want them to offend women who could give them financial support. And they thought that it wasn't right because she wanted to set up a group to advocate universal suffrage rather than limited suffrage. Next slide. So this is the East London Federation of Suffragettes, founded by Sylvia Pankhurst. Here she is in front of a bookshop which they took as their original headquarters. The people she's talking to are a mixture of working class men and working class women. And that's who she's trying to talk to. She's not trying to aim the message and trying to recruit women from a higher class. She's trying to get it out to anyone who's around on the street. In 1913, Sylvia was summoned to France, where Emily and Christabel were in hiding. They were trying not to be arrested, because obviously all the suffragettes were repeatedly arrested, and she was trying to evade arrest at this point. So Sylvia goes to France to see her sister and her mother, and is told basically that her group could either drop its working class convictions, its ideas of bettering conditions for all workers, or trying better conditions for women in their domestic and their social life, and to drop all this, or it would be expelled and excluded from the group. She said, well, no, this is what I believe in, this is what these women believe in. The vote, we need the vote to fight against poverty and destitution, not to brag that we're on equal terms to men. So, again, like they did with Adela, Emily and Christabel break away completely with their family because they have a completely different political conviction. Differences between groups can be seen in their reactions to war. In 1914, the Women's Social and Political Union stops all its campaigning for a vote and decides to work alongside the government, people they've been victimising, I suppose, they've been trying to hurt all these years, and they decide to work alongside them to try and call for things like conscription into the armed forces for men. They were women who organised giving out white feathers in Britain. Women who gave out white feathers, they gave them to men who refused to fight, and it was sort of seen as a sign of cowardice, and it was like a really horrible thing to do, and they were organised. It was organised by like members before this. What's different about the East London Federation of Suffragettes is that instead of working saying, oh yeah, let's go to war, they set up things like unemployment bureaus, they gave out free milk and they did things like childcare. They tried to better the wage gap between men and women, especially since women were now entering places in work that weren't have been taken by them. Again, the suffragette newspaper, which had been called Vox Women, was named Britannia, and it's like, well, they've dropped anything, they're trying to do anything they can, they're going to any means to try and get the vote for this small minority. So 1918 is the first measure of women's enfranchisement in England, in Britain. This is the Representation of the People Act, where women over 30 who were on the government register or met the property qualifications previously imposed on men were granted the vote. Women made up about a third of the electorate at this point. more women were enfranchised than they'd been aiming for. But what's quite interesting to note is that after this happened, these public figures who've been in the limelight for the past couple of decades completely drop out. They say, all right, well, we've got the vote for some women, we're not going to keep campaigning for women in other sectors. Okay, so what I said at the start is I was trying to work out, well, how could this be just due to the exploits of a few elite women, and what were working class women doing at that point? A group that I discovered upon reading the book One Hand Tied Behind Us, which is the only book written about this group, are called the Radical Suffragettes. These women were also from the North, which is where the WSP was originally founded. They were made up of loads and loads and loads of working class women, or women, whoever wanted to join in. They advocated things like birth control, wider social reforms, and adult suffrage. What they found campaigning a lot harder than the women in the suffragettes, because they had to work, they had to look after their children, and their contribution in the home and in work was so fundamental to keeping their children fed and things like that. The woman says, no cause can be won between dinner and tea, and most of us who were married has to work with one at a time behind us. Working class women within this group were then given a sort of platform to express their views that they'd never had in the area of suffrage before. Helen Silcock, for example, who's just your average mill worker, was really great, and she raised the issue of female suffrage at the notoriously hostile trade union conference in 1901. And this led to the trade union conference calling for a motion for adult suffrage to encompass both men and women, due to what she said in her speech. She said one of the reasons the government didn't enfranchise women was that they said that they were sufficiently protected by their husbands, and their husbands could vote for them. Why do they need two votes? They're just going to vote for the same people. But she said that not all women were married. And she points out that the vote would give women a means to step up and to better themselves in their lives, their social lives, their domestic lives, their day-to-day experiences. And it would enable them to live and not merely to exist. Selina Cooper, I think, is an example of a woman just from the social, class, the working class, who was really given opportunities she never had before due to the works of the group. The group, all these different women, were trying to, instead of going for sensationalist activities to raise the issue on a national level again, get it in the newspapers. They were running a grassroots campaign, trying to get trade unions involved, women's cooperative guilds involved, things like that, and try and bring into the ideas and the minds of working class women and women all over the country what getting the vote for them could mean. It's different. She became the first working class woman to be elected as a poor law guardian, who sort of looked after impoverished people, and the only working class woman who was chosen to present a petition to Parliament on women's suffrage to the Prime Minister Asquith. Again, what I said there, radical suffragists were suffragists because they couldn't be militant. There were examples of them throwing bricks and things like that, but they were mainly constitutional. The things that they do, their methods, were they sit outside their mills and just try and get women to sign. And they did manage it, and they managed to have a petition of over 60,000 names of working class women to try and bring on and gain suffrage for women. This is like a real important thing, I think, what the point that Selina Cooper said. He said, women do not want their political power to enable them to vote so they are on equal terms with men. They want it for the same purpose as men, to better conditions, make the lot of the worker pleasanter. We do not want it as a mere plaything. The radical suffragists, other groups, working class groups in the north, obviously had a lot of friction between the mainstream mainstream women's social and political union suffrage campaign, because they just couldn't understand what was the point in them trying to just get the vote and not letting their members involve themselves in other social forms and social struggles. Okay, so it's really important to see that women from all over the country, all their different classes, contributed to the effort of gaining enfranchisement for women. As I said, over 60,000 women signed that one petition, and that's just in the north of England. There were petitions all over the place. It wasn't just the exploits of a couple of well-known public figures that got women got women to vote in 1918. I think Christabel and the WSPU movement was a struggle for more privileged and educated women to take their seat in government and represent their class interests. And I think the differing views of Christabel and Sylvia really sum up the different ideas and approaches from different social circles to the question of suffrage and what it could mean and what its potential was. Then for Sylvia, the East London Federation of Suffragettes, the radical suffragists and other working class groups, the suffrage movement was the struggle for freedom from want, poverty and... Her purpose in the militant suffragette movement is seen as the main reason for women gaining the vote in 1918. But in fact, thousands of women from across the country and from every social class were involved. And they were the ones who brought the issue not just into the national media, but really down into people's day-to-day lives and got them thinking what it could mean if they were to be empowered in this way. The granting of suffrage in 1918 is in some ways attributed to women's contribution in the war effort. What's important to see is that women who really contributed in this way were working class women in their teens and their 20s. And they were the ones challenging the sort of Victorian idea of double standards, that women were inferior to men and incapable of carrying out the same tasks. Not the middle class conservative feminists who didn't really... They did things in the war like trying to get men to fight scripts and organise demonstrations and rallies to raise national morale, but not... They didn't actually contribute any way economically. Suffragists also showed that women for every class were capable of operating within a democracy. What was the problem with the militancy of the WSPU was that there were some people and groups who were really reluctant to give women the vote because they weren't sure what effects it would have upon them and whether they would become unfeminine. This is quite a late Victorian idea which carried on, that women who were empowered like this would lose their femininity and they'd become not women anymore. It's something really strange. Like, I found one source that said that if women were to vote, they would become lesbians and they would, like, they wouldn't be able to conceive because they could vote. That's ridiculous. But the problem with all the militancy and this sensationalism and the attacks that the WSPU did, this for some people was confirming the idea of what happened to women when they got involved in politics. And they didn't really see how people would react to the things that they were doing. Another issue was that during this time, obviously there's a lot of insurrection in Ireland at this point. The government didn't want to be seen to be giving in to terrorists, these women who were fighting, who were setting things on fire, attacking people, and stuff like that. And they were reluctant to give in to this terrorism. And that a problem with it was that it tainted the whole movement, even for women who weren't involved. Suffrage was then seen as something that was quite taboo even if they didn't agree with setting fire to houses or poisoning people's pets and things like that. Okay, so in terms of feminism and wider emancipation, the radical suffragists and the East London Federation of Suffragettes and other groups like that that we don't hear about, they really set the ground for campaigning for better lives for women, I think. Stuff like campaigning for birth control and bringing ideas like that down at a grassroots level is very important later on in more feminist movements that come prior and subsequent to the war. But the WSP were only interested in campaigning for the vote and not for wider social reform. I think that this is generally why it shouldn't be that the contribution of women from all these working class groups should be marginalised, but I think that the contribution of the WSP and the pankers should be lessened and should be seen as not as... people should see that it wasn't just them and that their contribution wasn't as big as and the only reason it was. WSP, because they weren't, because of their race and their issues with that, they weren't of that social sort of, they weren't at that level, so they weren't really involved in it. But they were, from sources I found about it, in terms of the East London Federation of Suffragettes particularly, they were involved and welcomed in that respect. But I think the WSP, I'm not sure what their policies were on race. But because it was so deeply embedded in class and people's, lots of black or minority people would be lower class, they wouldn't be, they weren't involved in the militancy at that point.
I'm not sure there was much of a black community in Britain at this time either, was there? I mean, the black community in Britain mainly arrived in the 50s, post-Second World War.
There are a few examples of women, black women being involved, especially in the East London Federation, but that, especially not in the mainstream thing that's seen as a real type of stuff.
And East London, I mean, it's got a, I think the history of kind of diverse groups of people beyond, you know, from outside of England is quite rich. And I'm by no means an expert, but
yeah.
So I would imagine that that context would be the most fertile for kind of finding the politics around suffrage, you know, different kinds of wings of suffragists and in relation to, you know, other groups.
That's true. In fact, Emmeline and Christabel were quite reluctant for Sylvia to set up a branch there, not just because it was very working class, because they were quite afraid of all the ideas and things that were embedded within that culture, because they were trying to attract conservative members. Feminists. They weren't trying to sort of, I don't know, trying to think how to phrase it really, like, bring people together from all different races and different classes. They were all just into conservativeness, so they didn't.
You suggested before there was a difference between the movement, the suffragette movement in the England and the United States.
I don't know that much about the movement within the United States. I know that some of the methods that were used, both by the suffragists and suffragettes, were employed in the United States, like rallies and things like that. But I'm not sure. I got, there's a very good book by a woman called Gerda Werner, putting, I think it's something that women in social and physical climate have read quite a long time ago, and that had quite a lot about how some more, again, more conservative feminists in America distance themselves from women, in certain women, in a way that the WSP is. But I've not really known much about that. That seems.
Right, yeah, well, let's give it a quick round.